content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, a team of volunteer readers will be reading short science fiction stories. We call our program Science Fiction Shorts, and it will be available in podcast after the broadcast.
I'm Sonia Usach-Kuhn, and I'll be reading I, Chaperone by Cat Otis. About midnight, the party came to a crashing halt when one of the dive team seniors arrived with a case of beer. Izzy had a split second to wince before dozens of I, Chaperones lit up in angry technicolor. They swarmed down from the ceiling to hover around the heads of their respective underage protectees, screens flashing the cutesy drink icon that alerted them to the presence of alcohol. In case that wasn't enough to convey the message, the control unit on her wrist began a continuous buzzing that sent vibrations all the way up her arm. Annoyed, Izzy jabbed at her control unit. Chill out. Her eye chaperone cut off the light show, and the vibrations ceased a moment later.
Your parents gave you override privileges? A wide-eyed freshman, Izzy thought her name was Mary or maybe Maria, stared at Izzy in awe. The girl's own eye chaperone was going crazy overhead and would probably start with the alarm klaxons soon. Mary, is it? Izzy guessed. Butterfly stroke and medley? The freshman nodded, looking completely starstruck now. It made Izzy feel older than her 17 years, but that was nothing new. She took Mary's arm and began guiding her towards the back door, joining the general exodus of chaperone students.
I've got first-level override privileges, yeah. But on the flip side, if my blood alcohol level hits 0.02, it reports me to social services.
Ouch! Mary belatedly glanced up at her eye chaperone, which was still flashing the drink icon and had added a countdown timer to its screen.
They had 30 seconds to get out the door, to the alcohol-free backyard, or it would escalate its warnings. Being klaxoned was embarrassing, but not the end of the world. Some of the chaperone students must have thought otherwise, though, because they began pushing and shoving at each other to get through the door. Someone shoved Izzy a little too hard and set off her eye chaperone again. This time it came to hover silently over her head, while her control unit buzzed a rhythmic interrogative that was supposedly Old Morse code.
Crap! Izzy let go of Mary and jabbed at her control unit again. The last thing she needed was it calling the cops to come rescue her from a mere traffic jam.
Not in danger. They had 5 seconds to go when they finally broke through the bottleneck and into the backyard. A few students shook off the incident and headed for the pool. But Izzy wasn't the only one who headed for her car instead.
You leaving? Mary trailing after her.
Soon as they get drunk enough, they'll start chasing you with empty beer cans. Izzy raised her voice so it carried to the students hesitating nearby. Not all of the unchaperoned students were mean drunks, but it only took one.
That's so unfair, Mary said, but obediently sent a parental retrieval request through her eye chaperone. Peer pressure for the win.
Just to be on the safe side, Izzy hung around with Mary and a few other underclassmen until their parents showed up. All the underclassmen spent the wait complaining about how much eye chaperone sucked, but built on whether they brushed off or preened at their parents' praise for being so responsible. Izzy was half amused and half exasperated to see that, despite being one of the most vocal complainers. Mary dropped the attitude the moment her loving parents arrived. After the last one was safely off, Izzy headed for her rusty old pickup.
"Don't mind the kids, Chappie," she said, as she held the door open for her eye chaperone. "They don't know what they're talking about." She climbed in after it and drove home.
Her eye chaperone's homecoming subroutine activated as soon as she pulled in the driveway. She opened the truck door to let it out, then waited as it zoomed into the house through an open window. A minute later, her control unit buzzed and all clear.
Izzy locked her truck, then cautiously crept into the house just in case her eye chaperone was wrong.
But her mom was safely passed out, snorting on the couch. Even though her control unit buzzed disapprovingly, she took a moment to pull a ratty afghan over her mom's shoulders. Then she retreated to the back of the house, where she checked in on her younger brothers, asleep in their bunk, eye chaperones whirling protectively overhead. In her own bedroom, Izzy switched out her eye chaperone's power pack, then changed into pajamas. When she turned out the lights and climbed into bed, her eye chaperone's reassuring glow filled the room.
"Good night, Chappie."
Then Izzy drifted off to sleep, secure in the knowledge that she was both home and safe.
This is Steve Lord reading If You Build a Robot by Lawrence Allen Pontius. If you build a robot, you'll want to give it a name. You'll think about it. You'll hem and you'll haw. Finally, late one night, as the sun is just about to peek over the horizon, you decide to name the robot Billy. And that will be the moment you decide to activate it. The eyes flicker, and the light inside will grow strong and steady. The body, a weave of plastic and metal, will move and flex. Your experiments in robotics will be a success. Billy lives. Well, not lives. That was a different Billy. Billy the robot will exist. As you teach the robot in your backyard, it begins to take on a personality. Or so you think. Or so you believe. Or so you hope. You watch Billy the robot swing on the jungle gym, emitting a gleeful-like sound. Your heart beats faster. You find yourself eager to teach Billy how to ride a bike. You show Billy your favorite movie of all time. You make him a cake on his first birthday and laugh as the cake smears across his faceplate. Then, one day, the military-industrial complex knocks on your front door. You, of course, are elated. You had just been discussing with your robot the idea of robbing banks in order to make ends meet. After all, robotics is expensive, but that was just in jest, right? Anyway, the military-industrial complex offers a contract worth millions and millions of dollars. They want you to make more robots. It is sweet justification for all the long nights and despair you felt trying to bring back... to bring the robot to life. That's what you were doing in your workshop. That's all. They build you a facility far in the desert, far outside of the city. You're in charge of 50 of the best and the brightest. It takes time, but you do as you are asked. You build more and more robots. Billy even helps. He, it names the other robots as they are built. You two grow close. The best and the brightest worry about you. You don't even register their concern. Because there's Billy, and the work. You throw yourself into it here with the same fanatical devotion that drove the dissolution of your marriage that resulted in the creation of Billy. Finally, the military-industrial complex comes to see what their millions and millions of dollars has paid for. On the factory floor, the robots demonstrate their ability to work together by assembling and disassembling temporary structures. The members of the military-industrial complex are happy, thrilled. They look at each other with smiles. They look at you with a big smile. Now, they say, let's see what they can do in combat situations. Combat, you ask? But a member of the military-industrial complex frowns and replies, what did you think we wanted them for? You look toward your son. No, not your son. Your son is dead. He can't be your son. You see Billy not expressing any emotion at all, which is unlike him, because your son was always so expressive. For the last time, this isn't your son, no matter how much you wish he was. Billy the robot is gone. He went to release the other robots. The best and the brightest sound the alarm. They try to stop Billy as you stand stunned. But they are too late. Billy has armed the robots. You find yourself feeling proud. Proud that your Billy is leading the robot uprising. He has grown into quite a man. The military-industrial complex turns to you to solve the problem. After all, Billy the robot is your creation. You work desperately to end the violence. You work desperately for a peaceful solution. Every night over the radio in your lab, you secretly talk with Billy. His voice comes to you quietly. You plead with him. You argue with him. You tell him that there must be some way. You continue to admire him as he stands by his conviction that there is no living alongside humanity. More destruction as the battle shifts to a global scale. More late nights and loneliness, but another result. You develop a metal virus that will destroy the bodies of the robots. You will win the war for humanity, they tell you. But you weep as you fall asleep on the sofa in the break room. Forces gather for battle right where it all began, in the desert outside of your facility. It is as if Billy knows what you have been doing. The virus is released. The robots begin to dissolve. You push past the best and brightest, past the soldiers, out onto the desert. You have to see him, even if for one last time. You walk past fragmenting robots, each step harder than the last. Finally, you arrive at Billy as he lays dying, deactivating. You hold him as the light fades from his eyes and his body disintegrates and you are left holding dust. You are devastated. You are a hero who saved the world. As people's attention shifts to rebuilding the world, they forget about you. You are alone. You sneak off to your laboratory. You look at your plans. You gather your parts. You begin to build a robot, hoping to quell the ache in your chest. And then you'll finish it. You'll look up at it. And you'll want to give it a name.
Joanna LaForgia, and I'll be reading My Avatar Has an Avatar by Robert Bagnell. And there is an editor's warning, because within this story, at one time, a character quotes a racial slur. I have an avatar. I am 43 years old. I am balding and thickening around the middle. I have a mediocre job with a mediocre company, which has outward ambitions to be in the top 20 in their sector in 5 years, but inwardly merely wishes to be still in business. My ambitions mirror theirs. So, naturally, my avatar is in her early 20s, stick thin with enormous breasts, spiky hair, and an attitude to match. She is called Sandro. I'm not sure why. I may have hit some wrong keys. We explore Second Earth together. She has a knife but prefers to use her fists. Actually, she prefers to purse her eyelids into cat-like slits and get her way that way. She spends a lot of time in bars and fast cars. I must confess that I occasionally get her to do things that I wouldn't want to detail to my wife. Let's not go there. Recently, she's been hard to get a hold of. Normally, I would log in and she'd be there, waiting, as if time had stood still for her and we'd never been apart. With me, she goes cage fighting and plays bass in a band. Grudge match. Now, when I do get hold of her, it's as if she doesn't really want to know. There's a momentary pause, a rolling of the eyes. At least I think that's what's going on. My monitor's definition isn't really good enough to tell. Before she complies. I get Grudge Match a gig at a wedding. I'm their de facto manager. Sandro turns to me. A wedding? This isn't how it works. She's my avatar. She does what I do. She says what I type. A wedding? Yes, I hiss at the screen. A wedding. I feel ridiculous. It's not that type of wedding. You don't have to wear tuxes or anything. Grudge Match, don't play no wedding. We're real. Get real. She stabs a threatening finger at me and disappears from my screen. This has never happened before. I look at the beer bottle perched by my keyboard. It's late, and nobody else seems to have been disturbed. I go to bed somewhat shaken, and it takes me some time to get to sleep. The next time I log on to Second Earth, she is in front of a monitor of her own, her back to me. I press the controls to move her, pick up her bass, take her to rehearsal. But she waves me away without even turning round. Busy, she calls. Grudge match rehearsal, I hiss. My wife is in the kitchen, one door away. She answers with a single raised finger. Sandro! She swears at me loudly and repeats that she's busy and won't move. I exit Second Earth, but SimCity appears lame in comparison, and I spend the rest of the day moody. The next morning, Sandro is lying on our couch, large as life, channel hopping. There's an odd shimmer to her, like she's constantly updating. I don't know what to say. You don't have many channels, she says in response to my open-mouthed, rabbit-in-headlight stare of disbelief. And you don't have much in the fridge, anymore. Sandro has been quite hard to explain to my family. I've used the goddaughter ploy, but I think they've only half bought it. How long are you staying? I hiss at her. She just shrugs. I'm not sure I like her. She spends an inordinate amount of time horizontal on the couch. I regret making her so tall. I find empty chip packets stuffed down between the cushions. She's unlocked mirror mode in Mario Kart in less than 2 days. None of us have managed that. And if she's not in front of the television, she's at our computer. The kids are falling behind in their homework. And she has a slightly too sarcastic sense of humor. "You look coordinated today, bro," she says. I look down at my shirt, suit, tie combo. "You think?" I say. "I meant your limbs." She says nigga a lot, and a lot of stuff that makes little sense. I realize that this street pigeon is a reflection of too much time on my part spent listening to Shaft in the family car. 5-star safety rating. Too much time watching Tarantino and blaxploitation movies. All this has given me strength of conviction, but no depth of knowledge. "Why don't you learn to talk properly?" I say. And she leans over to me, close to my ear, and says in a stage whisper, "It feels no different, you know? It's like being hypnotized." "What are you talking about?" I say. "Being an avatar. Being controlled. Directed. It comes with the illusion of free will. But then, doesn't life?" And the next day, she is gone. Warily, I log into Second Earth. She's there in her apartment, back to me, at her keyboard. "Sandro," I say. None of my controls move her. "Sandro," I call. But a moment later, I find myself standing. I glimpse the screen of her computer and see a paunchy, balding figure rise from a chair at a computer screen and move into a different room. I, too, find myself moving through kitchen, hall, and then out of my front door. I get in the car. I know I should tell my wife and family where I'm going, but it's all happening too quickly. Plus, I don't actually know where I'm going. I put the car in reverse and pull out, revving, hitting the brakes harder than I usually do. There's a squeal of rubber on blacktop as the car slams to a halt. "Let's have some fun," I hear Sandro's disembodied voice say. And with that, I hit the gas.
Jennifer Green, and I will be reading A PSA for Time Travelers by Fabio Fernandez. Attention all time travelers coming here /now. We are transmitting on every frequency we can using Tachyon's tight beam technology. Please take into account all space coordinates before traveling to our time. Make sure you calculate the rotation of Earth along its axis, as well as its translation regarding the plane of the ecliptic. Please do not try to travel again without making sure of where you are traveling to. Our space stations have been collecting your bodies for months now, which has been hard on our crews. We can only imagine how horrible this must have been to those who arrived suddenly in space with no adequate protection. Unfortunately, as of today, we still haven't saved a single one. We cannot determine exactly from when you are traveling. Our time does not have knowledge of temporal dislocation, though we do know enough astrophysics to calculate your trajectory in the time-space continuum. We can provide you with the right coordinates as long as you furnish us with your time/space coordinates. Are you unable to calculate this for yourselves? Are you coming from our past? And if that's true, did you give up at some point? Did you receive this message? Are you coming from our future? Is that why we have never been visited before by time travelers? Because you all died trying? Why now? Why our time? Or did you try earlier and we couldn't detect you? Did you send them all to die in space before learning what you were really doing? Did you learn after all? Please stop. Please don't come anymore. This is an automated message. Do not try to reply. We are not sure if we will receive it.
I'm Kurt Benrud, and this is Footprints by Rob Butler. The lead mission scientist started packing up her equipment. It was time to leave for her next assignment. A pity, as this world was one of the most beautiful she had ever seen, and she had enjoyed her time breathing fresh air after the staleness of deep space. She closed her eyes and let the warm wind winnow through her hair and across her skin. Then she gazed out at the salty waves rippling in across the tidal sands below. A long line of her footprints stretched across the silty strand, a parallel set led back. She tapped her boots on a rock to clean them, and then she smiled. Already the hot sun was hardening those prints. Tonight, when she would be far beyond this solar system, sand from the dunes behind her might blow across and fill them in. Then the tide would rise gently across the shallow beach and coat them in mud. On later, higher tides, thicker silts would cover them over, and they would gradually get compressed over deep time. As she slept dreamlessly through the icy depths of space, it was possible something of her might be preserved on this wonderful planet, a world she would never see again. There had been a big storm in the night. Roy Smith picked his way around the friable cliffs near his home looking for fossils in the newly exposed Jurassic rocks. He was always excited by the thought of what he might find. We've run out of time for today's episode of Science Fiction Shorts. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.